The following podcast contains one tiny little word of bad language, which did technically come out of my mouth, but I'm going to blame Jean-Claude Juncker. Hello, Dominic in Amsterdam.
Hello, Katie in Paris.
How are you? What's going on?
I'm fine. I'm a bit tired because it's quite early in the morning and I had a show open last night. It was good because I got rid of my sling yesterday.
Yay!
And that was definitely an advantage because in the dress rehearsal, I was wearing this like really heavy Austrian bondage-like sling.
Oh, I see. Sorry. I thought that was part of your costume.
No. This was for my broken shoulder. The opening scene, we have to like all start stripping off because it's like in a brothel and have this like sexy time and orgy.
Oh, wow.
The sling was kind of awkward.
I can imagine that being a bit of a mood killer. I mean, in a real life orgy as much as an onstage one.
Yeah, well, I actually got mixed reviews from people who were in the audience. A few people who didn't know I'd broken my shoulder came up to me and were like, wow, I love that like bondage thing you were wearing. And others were like, yeah, you did look like this like one-armed man like crawling around the stage.
But now you're completely free to be in an orgy. Do you end up completely naked in this thing?
No, not completely naked, just trousers off and with my little pink Y fronts.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah, it's kind of up to you how much of your clothes you take off. Only the people who are there as actors, as opposed to singers, actually have to get completely naked and they get paid extra.
Oh, do they? I feel like I would be sitting there fully clothed, just shaking my head like, nope. Mm-mm.
Just smoking in the corner.
Not my thing. Sorry, guys.
Oh my God, while I'm talking about the opera, can I have a rant about something European?
Go on.
This is something really important that the European Commission needs to start thinking about. There is no standardized way of describing the left and the right-hand side of the stage within Europe. And this really is a problem when it's an international world. So this may sound really flippant, but actually it's so annoying during rehearsals when the director's like, okay, can you move a bit to the left? And in England, we say stage left and stage right, which means from the stage, looking out to the audience, your left and your right. But in Dutch, they say recht and links, meaning from the audience's side.
Oh my God.
And in France, they say cour and jardin, so...
Cour et jardin. That's very quaint sounding. Court and garden. It sounds like it must have been from an old country house back in the day.
It's to do with the Tuileries, apparently.
Oh,
because
wow.
The theatre was situated between the Jardin des Tuileries and the Cour de Carousel.
Right, yeah. That bit down near the river and the Louvre and all that stuff.
But you didn't tell me how you've been.
I have been well. I am going to London to hang out with my boyfriend and his family. We're going to see the circus, which will be very nice.
Oh, will it? Are there any animals?
No, it's Cirque du Soleil, so it's all like humans doing crazy things.
Okay, you're going to see Cirque du Soleil.
I know, it's super cool. At the Albert Hall. It's going to be amazing.
Oh, I'm jealous. I've never seen them.
I know, it's going to be super, super cool.
We might have some new listeners this week because, I'll just drop this in there casually, we were listed as one of the 5 podcasts that could change you.
I think it said like change your perspective or something. Change you sounds weird.
I swear it just said change you. Oh, I might have made that up.
Anyway, we were very kindly listed by the British Podcast Awards on their mailing list under their top 5 podcasts that will change your perspective, change the way you think, something like that. And we were delighted. So we're really looking forward to seeing a huge wave of new listeners coming in. But for those of you joining us this week for the first time, welcome. We are the podcast that's going to make Europe great again. It's been a very busy week in Europe, hasn't it, Dominic?
Yes.
What we thought we'd do is this week try out a sort of new mini featurette in our intro where we talk very briefly about who has been having a good week in Europe and who's been having a bad week. Shall I go first with the bad?
Yeah.
And then we can end on a more positive note. It has been a bad week for Volkswagen, Germany's largest car maker, obviously the world's biggest car maker, in fact, because they have been gassing monkeys. Volkswagen, it emerged, locked some monkeys in small airtight chambers and made them breathe in diesel fumes while watching cartoons. Basically, they were trying to prove that diesel is less polluting than it used to be because we've got all this new cleaning technology. I feel like making them watch cartoons made it so much worse somehow, although I couldn't really tell you why.
Surely that makes it better because it gives him something to do.
No, but it's just so hideous somehow. Just the image of it. Ugh. Anyway, so this is like gone down in like a lead balloon, basically. It turns out that senior Volkswagen managers knew that this was happening. They weren't the only company doing this. Daimler and BMW, also massive German brands, were also funding the research.
How did that happen? Were they all like talking to each other, being like, monkeys? Should we give monkeys a go?
But it's a problem for all of the brands. It makes all of these car makers look pretty terrible, but it is extra bad for VW because they were already in loads of trouble for fixing cars with devices to help them cheat on pollution tests.
You say they were in trouble and that it was such a big story, but people seem to have forgotten about that. I've been really surprised that VW haven't come under more criticism for, I mean, fitting things, devices, to alter the levels of pollution during testing. Like, that's so corrupt.
Yeah, and in fact, I've just looked up the sales for this year, and they actually went up. They sold 10.7 million cars last year, ahead of Toyota. So it seems like people don't really care that much, which is a little bit sad. Cheer us up, Dominic. Who's been having a good week?
Oh, okay. So it's been a good week for Jean-Claude Juncker, who has announced that he believes that 1 million babies have been born as a result of the Erasmus Student Exchange Programme.
Aww.
I know. I mean, he said, "We increased the European libido, if I may say so," end quote. And I think for that comment alone, he deserves the going up position.
What an image.
I kind of can't decide whether just to brush over this figure. So 1 million babies.
Probably bullshit.
There have only been 3 million students since 1987. So it was based on responses from 80,000 graduates of the Erasmus programme. So they didn't just pick the figure out of nowhere. But I have to say, I haven't read the entire study because it is 227 pages long.
And you were too busy cavorting on stage in an orgy. I understand.
Absolutely.
And that's quite a big sample size, but it does sound mad. Maybe like only super fertile people responded to the survey.
Yeah, or like super horny people.
There's a strong correlation between horniness and filling out surveys. It has been noted before. Do you want to hear another spurious sex-related EU figure?
Yeah, go on.
I was reading on the internet yesterday that apparently 10% of Europe's population, by one estimate, was conceived in an IKEA bed.
Wow.
Which brings us up very neatly to our first guest. You probably saw that the Swedish founder of IKEA, Ingvar Kamprad, died last week at the age of 91. There aren't many companies that have had such a huge impact on the way that we live and the stuff inside our homes. So we are going to be talking to one of IKEA's in-house designers in Sweden about what it's like to actually design the stuff that ends up in millions of homes around the world.
And after that, we're going to be calling up Andrea Venzon, who is the founder and president of Volt Europa. They are a pan-European progressive party and political movement who are just starting out and hoping to start fielding candidates around the continent soon.
Will they take over the world? Let's find out. How do you feel about IKEA, Dominic?
I really like it because it's affordable and you can make your place look kind of nice for super cheap. I mean, it's just so much cheaper than all the alternatives and quite a lot of it looks quite simple and nice.
Are you allowed to go to IKEA? Because your husband is quite like design. I always remember when he was buying a sofa, he went through the process very thoroughly.
Oh, yeah, we weren't allowed to buy an IKEA sofa, that's true. He wanted something that was more like Danish design, like modernist style.
As opposed to Swedish, sure.
Have you got a flat full of IKEA furniture?
I have. Actually, if I turn around, I can see a IKEA bed and an IKEA sofa that were both built with my own hands. Well, more like my boyfriend's hands, but I helped.
So many times when I call you or try to call you, I get a text message from you being like, "Hey, just in IKEA, I'll call you back later."
It's true. Previous listeners will know that I have tried to argue on this podcast before that going to IKEA and building IKEA is the quintessential European experience, but you knocked me down on that one. I got beaten down.
I did, yeah.
But yeah, no, I'm very fond of IKEA. I think like a lot of people, I get frustrated with the whole building process. But I enjoy going. I quite like the ritual of going to eat the meatballs in the canteen there. And especially when I lived in Hong Kong, going to IKEA is really fun because Hong Kongers use IKEA as a place to sleep.
What?
Yeah. Like, you won't find a single sofa that isn't, like, covered with, like, old people and students slumped on the sofa like dead bumblebees.
And that's okay.
Yeah, well, like, it's just kind of really culturally tolerated. Hong Kong's, like, a really densely populated place. And IKEA, I guess, compared to people's tiny little homes, is relatively peaceful. Plus, I think it makes sense. Like, if you're going to buy a sofa, which is designed for napping on, you should see if it's comfortable for napping on. Makes sense.
Yeah, that's true. Try before you buy.
But it's been quite interesting just learning about the IKEA story this week, because obviously Ingvar Kamprad died and I didn't really know much about like how it was set up or anything. And it's really, really interesting. What an interesting figure, you know, like,
yeah,
complicated guy, really interesting personality, had this very modest life. Used to go on like cycling holidays with the founder of H&M, who was a close friend.
Really?
Yeah. And he's very simple. He used to buy a lot of his clothes from flea markets and stuff like that. But he had problems in his life as well. You know, he struggled with alcoholism a lot. In the 90s, he admitted that he had had Nazi sympathies back in the 40s and said that he regretted it. He was one of the richest men in the world. But relatively little of that is going to his family, because he set up this really complicated structure where like IKEA is spread out everywhere. It's really interesting. So most of the stores are owned by a Dutch foundation.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which was set up to support charities and designers. And then there's different bits owned by different countries. So the brand and the logo are owned by a company in Liechtenstein.
Is this just like one of these typical, whenever I hear about a brand being based in Liechtenstein, I think this is just tax avoidance.
Yes, well, so does the European Union, because they are currently investigating whether it's a tax avoidance thing.
Okay.
So, you know, there's the good and the bad in that. More than any other company in Sweden, perhaps in Europe, has had such a huge impact on like just our everyday lives and the stuff that is in all of our homes.
And it really does seem that some of his core ideas have created what is so brilliant about IKEA. Like, he founded it at the age of 17 in the 1940s, and it initially was something a bit different, but by the 50s he'd already come up with this idea of creating flat pack furniture, which was really revolutionary, and he's wanted to keep it affordable.
Yeah.
But we are now going to call one of the current designers at IKEA, Sara Fugger, who will hopefully tell us a bit more about the ideology of the company and the process of designing some furniture.
Yeah, we're going to give her a ring at home in Älmhult in southern Sweden, which is where the first ever IKEA store was.
Lots of different types of things. I know you've designed sofas and microwave lids. Is there something that makes them quintessentially IKEA?
Yeah, more or less. We have something that we call democratic design, and that is a tool that we use, or kind of we work with when we develop products. So every product that we have in our range should be of this democratic design. And it's built up with five parameters. It's form, it's function, it's quality, sustainability, and all these four to a good price.
Are you aware that well, amongst my friends anyway, we talk about like the IKEA test when you're dating someone of like a new relationship, whether you can like put a piece of furniture together and still like not want to banish the other one to an island. But I was wondering, at what stage in your design process do you have to start thinking about how this is going to be put together?
As an IKEA designer, you really have to have that from start, because I mean, that's in the IKEA DNA, that everything that we sell should have a smart package. I mean, it should be flat, it should be stackable. Absolutely, we need to have that with us from start. And then, of course, it's very important that we don't make people kill each other when they're going to assemble our products. So we're working hard with that to avoid this situation.
Is your own home still full of IKEA objects?
More or less. I'm married to a designer, so we have a combination of a lot of different brands.
Have you had to build any of the IKEA things in your home? And I was wondering if you've ever had like the usual problem, the usual confusion.
Yes. We have a kitchen, for example, for IKEA. That can be maybe frustrating from start, but then since you're going to assemble so many things that are the same, you learn how to do it, then it just gets a little bit boring because you have to do it so many times over and over again. And then another one, actually, I bought recently another product from IKEA, and it was a little bit difficult to put together, actually. So I did some feedback on this so we can maybe develop it a little bit better. It's hard to tick in all those boxes of democratic design that we have put up for ourselves, but we're trying our best. We can develop things that's not working so well.
It's so nice that many of these goals really come from Ingvar's own ideology at the beginning. And I loved hearing these stories about how he was really careful with his money even when he became a multi-billionaire.
He really lived the myth, you can say that. But it's in the whole IKEA culture. It's not the being greedy or anything. It's about being really smart and doing things in a different way, in a more smarter way.
Tell us about the design process. How does it work? Do you come up with an idea and say to IKEA, hey, like, I want to make a new chair? Or is it very much IKEA coming to the design and saying, look, we need a new chair, make a new chair?
If I come up with a good idea, I know who I can develop this with. But our project starts long before they're launched in the stores. We gather information in a really wide scope through home visits and long before we develop products. We have developed a range strategy. Mm-hmm. And when that is set, the project is formulated into a brief, and then a designer gets the assignment. It can be years. It really depends on the project. You usually would say maybe 18 months to 2 years.
I saw on your Instagram that you have been recently briefed with making the most comfortable chair in the world. How's that going?
Well, I'm working hard on it. That's also on my to-do list today. Maybe in 18 months I can call you back, and then I can say when it's finished.
So we are now going to give Andrea Venzon a call, the founder of Volt Europa, a new progressive pan-European party. They have big ambitions, and I'm really interested to speak to him and find out how things have been going.
Can I just ask you, Dominic, it was you who found this, and you sent me a link from the Daily Express newspaper in Britain. What were you doing reading the Daily Express? For foreign listeners, the Daily Express is a newspaper in Britain that is famous for covering really just, I think, three main themes in life. One, immigrants are terrible people. Two, here is a new cure for diabetes or Alzheimer's. Usually it's like toast or something like that. And three, Princess Diana. It's a fun newspaper. What were you doing reading it?
I wasn't reading it, but I was just like searching the web, as you do, for European youth movements, and stumbled across it. And the only people that have written about this are the Daily Express so far.
We're in good company. So it's going to be really interesting to maybe get a slightly different perspective, because the way that the Express wrote about them sounded quite disapproving, saying that they want a United States of Europe, compared them to Momentum in Britain, which is this hard left Labour group that the Express itself doesn't like very much. There's a little sort of fear-mongering tone about it. So it'll be interesting to see what they have to say for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really new group, and it's interesting that it hasn't been picked up yet by a lot of the MSM and mainstream media. So we're getting in there early. But I don't think that means that they're not going to be successful. I think they seem to be growing very quickly.
So just to get it straight, I think they are interested in running candidates in elections in different European countries and in the European elections. It's interesting timing, because at the moment in Europe, there's this idea being floated that when Britain leaves, sorry, we're not supposed to talk about it, but it is going to come up. When Britain leaves, there are going to be a bunch of EU Parliament seats up for grabs. And there's this idea going around that maybe we should have like a pan-European list of candidates. So I might have a Danish MP, for example, representing me in France, which is kind of cool. So maybe it will come up there. Who knows?
Maybe it will. Thank you so much for joining us, Andrea. How are you? How are you doing?
I'm all good. I'm all good. I'm in the foggy Milan today, northern Italy, and the day could not start better than talking with you guys.
Oh, you've won us over already.
Yeah.
I wonder, could you start by introducing our listeners to what Volt Europa is and how it came about?
So we started this movement now 9 months ago. Volt is a progressive pan-European movement. So we are trying to build a movement that would then give birth to the first truly transnational political party. This came as an idea to me more than 1 year ago, right after the Brexit. So the Brexit happened. I was still working in the private sector, and I realized that no political parties were actually standing up for the values that I hold dear to my heart, and that a political project such as the EU and all the values attached to it were, for the first time in my life, in danger. It started like a conversation. So I involved some friends and colleagues that I believe could be interested, and we set up a little group, and we opened up a Facebook page on the March 29th, 2017, the day of the notification of the Brexit. And again, we had no big money, no big names, or no big political endorsement, just a group of citizens. And now we are more than 1,400 people in 16 European countries. So
wow.
it grew quite well, especially given the fact that we focus a lot on like internal capacity building and political program development instead of just doing, you know, classic marketing or outreach outside, because we wanted to be sound and strong before actually proposing something. And of course, then we have this pan-European message that is quite innovative on the political scene.
We're quite interested in this show in trying to work out what it means to be European and talking about European identity, because I think a lot of people around Europe, obviously, if you ask them, they won't say, I'm a European. They'll say, I'm Italian, I'm British, whatever. Have you always felt this kind of strong pull to Europe, or is it a fairly new thing for you?
So personally, I always felt it. So I grew up as an Italian in a European context. So I travel quite a lot, had the opportunity to have friends outside my borders, and I felt European from the beginning, but I don't think that being European was stronger than being Italian or being Milanese for me. I'd be like in the US, people feel American, but they also feel Californian and from their own town. So I really think that the future for this continent is to be able to express better what Europeans mean and also keep strong roots in your local community, because at the end, people have problems and solutions at local level. It's impossible to forget this attachment. It's impossible to forget our cultural heritage. What is still needed is to find the right balance between these levels. Then maybe thanks to the Erasmus and other projects, a new generation of people is, let's say, moving toward the right balance, but there's still a lot of work to do.
I mean, it seems like it's a really nice, ambitious idea that might be embraced by politicians such as Macron and Jean-Claude Juncker. Have you had any support from existing political institutions or politicians yet?
So we had no people backing us. We had conversation with other political actors in Brussels and also at national level. But so far, we decided that the best thing for us is to continue as we are doing. And we decided to go independently. Mm-hmm. In 1 year from now, when we are going to probably campaign for our first electoral target, there's going to be the European election in 2019, then we might be working with some political actors, but it's not our priority. Our priority is to really create something and then see what's the best way to achieve our results.
Just looking at the pictures on your Facebook page, it looks like a quite young crowd of people that are getting excited about this project. You've got an event at the London School of Economics University coming up quite soon. Is this a project specifically for young people, or is everyone invited?
Everyone is invited. We started mainly with a young crowd because me as a founder and the other starting group, we were quite young, and so we naturally attracted people from our network. And I would say that the average age was around 30 years old at the beginning.
How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 26.
Oh, so young.
And after that, we start reaching out to other segments of the population. So we're actually doing a really strong effort to diversify our supporter base. It's really cool to have a young starting base, but we need to go beyond that to actually have a bigger weight. But I'm really happy that we started as a young crowd, because I've really seen the young people have to activate more and take up more responsibility.
I found out about you from an article that I read that was comparing you to the Momentum movement in the UK, this movement that's been created to support Jeremy Corbyn's rise. Do you think that's a fair comparison, or do you see yourself as completely different?
Probably in terms of supporter base and the kind of grassroots movements, we could be compared. But in terms of political values and political direction, I wouldn't feel super confident in associating myself right now to an existing political party. The only labels that we attach to ourselves right now is progressive, because let's say it embodies most of our values. Being a transnational party, having labels is really difficult, because what means progressive in Portugal might be different from what it means in Romania.
I wonder if you had to sort of make your sales pitch, Andrea, to a young person, or not even a very young person, in Bulgaria or Germany or Ireland, about why a pan-European party is a solution to all the crappy things in our lives, what would you say?
The problems that we are facing encompasses our borders. So it's not like unemployment is just in Italy, or climate change, we're just going to affect Poland. But these are trends that are bigger than our nation states. We have to step up and take up responsibility as a continent.
What does Volt actually stand for? Do you have a policy platform yet, or is it more about just having broad values for the moment?
In 15 days, we're going to publish our first 20 flagship policies, so positioning on all key topics of European politics and also some national competence like education, health, and so on. And this is going to be the basis of our political program they want to put forward for the European campaign that we start in around September, October. So I don't want to spoil anything, but in 15 days, you're going to have everything online and well-publicized.
Which countries have taken to this the quickest?
Our main countries are Italy and Germany. There are more than 200 activists there. Then we have France, the UK, the Netherlands, Belgium, Romania, Poland, Spain, Portugal. We are just opening up Ireland. 16, 17 countries are already active. And then we have seen small groups all over Europe that are kicking off our new teams.
If some of our listeners listen to you speak and think, yeah, this is something I really want to get involved with, what should they do?
First thing would be to go on our website and subscribe either as a team member or volunteers. It depends on the time availability they have. We have like several functional team, fundraising, strategy, policy team, and really support or simply, you know, organize events at local level and be active as a supporter. Then if you have less time, just come at our events or subscribe as an active member, and you're going to still have a say voting on our most important decisions, but there is no time commitment requirement.
I have a really juicy happy ending for you this week. You'll be happy to hear, Katie, that for the second week in a row, it's not from Great Britain. I am taking you to Seville, the land of oranges and beautiful Moorish architecture.
Oh, it sounds warm and nice.
It may be warm and nice, but there is danger. News broke this week that a major crime has been foiled, and we all need to celebrate the success of the Spanish police. This story even has a car chase. The police noticed some suspicious cars on the motorway, and they started chasing them and eventually got them to stop. And when they did, they found that there were two cars and one van completely packed to the rafters with civilian oranges. The drivers initially claimed that they had picked them for themselves, but it soon transpired that they had raided a warehouse. There were 4,000 kilos of them. Part of the reason why I like this story is because of the photos that are attached to it. The Spanish police tweeted some photos of these cars full of oranges, and it is quite a sight. And literally, as they open the doors, the oranges like fall onto the road. Hundreds of oranges everywhere. It's quite beautiful.
We should retweet those pictures so the world can see.
We should.
Oh, that's nice. Well done, civilian police. Or as they say in Spain, felicitaciones.
Thank you for listening to the Europeans podcast once again. Please do follow us on Twitter if you don't already, at EuropeansPod. And send us an email if you've got any suggestions of really interesting people in Europe that you think we should interview, or even if you are an interesting person in Europe, which I'm sure you are. Our email address is europeanspodcast@gmail.com.
Our website, if you enjoy really big, colourful pictures of Angela Merkel, is europeanspodcast.com. And what I wanted to do specifically this week is thank a few of you specifically who've been really, really helpful in helping us to spread the word on the internet about the podcast. We would like to thank Marion in Düsseldorf, Will in Athens, Prashant in London. Happy birthday to you, by the way. Marcio in... Where is Marcio? Do you know where he is?
No.
I think he's in Strasbourg. Maybe you're in Strasbourg, let us know. Hedwig in Hamburg and Simon in Vienna. Oh, and also 156 Sharknose on Twitter. We don't know where you are, but thank you very much for your support. We might start sending people cakes or something like that for shout outs, but for now, you're going to have to just make do with a...
With a shout out.
With another shout out. I think that's fair.
So we'll be back next week with whatever fresh happenings have been going on in this lovely, beautiful continent of ours. In the meantime, make sure you don't eat any apricot stones because they're full of cyanide.
I don't know if all of them are. Wasn't it specifically those Dutch ones that are full of cyanide?
No, they all contain cyanide. I mean, you can eat a few of them. Just don't eat more than five a day.
God, quite ironic for a health food product.
I know, isn't that terrible? And apparently it did say on it, don't eat more than five a day. But they were like placed next to the cashews and the peanuts. And who reads like a packet of nuts?
But also, who eats an entire packet in one go?
Oh, have you never done that with cashews?
No, I've done it with like Mars bars, but yeah. I'm not really a cashew kind of gal. Anyway, whether you are forming a pan-European party this week or just, you know, sitting on your IKEA sofa, see what I did there?
Oh.
Watching Netflix. Have a great week, listeners, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
I was wondering if you have any Swedish tongue twisters you might be able to give us.
I have one. It's very difficult, especially if you're not Swedish. So I would like to hear you do it later.
No.
Okay. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Sju sjösjuka sjömän sköttes av sju sköna sjuksköterskor.
That sounds pretty easy. That's just kind of like...
Yeah.
No, Katie, no, stop.
Just a lot of pages.
And what does it mean?
It means seven sick sailors were taken care of by seven beautiful nurses.
Oh.
Oh, that's kind.